Welcome to the conversation that every woman should be having. I'm Maya Fisher-French, and my co-host and inspiration for this podcast is Andrea Carr. Now, Andrea experienced a life event that 50% of married couples will experience, if not once in their lifetimes, possibly twice, three times, and that is divorce. And this experience made Andrea realize that some of the choices that she had made financially as a mother, as a wife, and even as a woman had undermined her financially, emotionally, perhaps. And how over time she realized the importance of looking after herself and not only her family. And I think this is true, whether you are in whether you're getting divorced or if you're in a relationship for life, at some point statistically you are going to be on your own. And it's that fear that brought me to the point at which I realized that I did fear being alone, and especially financially alone, but I wasn't in fact happy, and it was time for my marriage, sadly, to come to an end. And I've realized through this process that at the age of 40, with an A-type personality, a good education, some life experience, a good career, if I had to do a redo of my life, There are some decisions that I would make differently with context and the experience that I've got through this process. I also realized that there are so many conversations that we just don't seem to have. When we go through life-changing events like we do as women, like we do as married couples, whether it's the decision to get married, the decision to have children, then starting a family, we focus all of our efforts at the time on the short-term decisions, and those are the easier ones to make. And as a result, certainly in my own case, there are so many conversations I never had around the long-term implications of making life-changing events happen, like the ones that we had. And it was very recently, I sat down with a group of girlfriends who I've known for 20 years, basically my entire adult life, and I realized that we were having conversations for the very first time about how they had all decided to get married and the marital contracts that they had in place, how they set up their family and household finances. I asked them whether they were protecting themselves as individuals. And this is the first time in 20 years that we had had these kinds of conversations. And that was a very scary thought. And Andrea, I think that's exactly the conversation you and I had when we decided to do this, these conversations. And because we felt that your experience we could use to help and to educate so many people in relationships around these dynamics, that are going to exist. So we've put together these four episodes. We're going to be speaking to a prominent family lawyer today. We also are going to be speaking to a financial planner, a fiduciary expert, and a relationship therapist to help us navigate these conversations. And give you information that you probably may not even know that you need. So that's what we're here to do. But Andrea, I want to really position this and for our listeners to help them understand your story, because I think it will resonate with so many women out there.
So my story starts 14 years ago when I got married. I have since had two children. They're currently 9 and 11. And I'm formally separated and have got divorce proceedings following imminently. Got married 14 years ago with an antenuptial contract with a accrual. I never at the time questioned what that meant. It was the advice I was given, and at the time it made sense. Didn't have too many conversations around it or debates around what that would mean for me in the long term. I came from a far more humble beginning than my spouse, and I entered into that marriage with virtually no assets. I just finished paying off a student loan, and I had no other family money to my name. I graduated almost 20 years ago with a business science degree, and I've worked in financial services, at management consulting, and in IT for the last 18 years. When I had kids, we decided it was going to be best for me to reduce my hours, and I worked part-time for about 4 years until my kids were old enough to go to nursery school. And at the point at which they were back at school, I realized it wasn't actually sustainable to work in that industry part-time, and I went back to work full-time. For the majority of the last decade, the father of my children focused very heavily on his career. And in the industry in which he works, that unfortunately means a lot of travel and a lot of time away. And the natural implication of that means that I picked up the invisible load of raising children. It was just a natural reaction. Someone had to raise the kids. And what that means when working full time is a lot. It's managing schedules. It's learning who your kids' friends are, building social lives, providing emotional support, making sure that there are groceries in the fridge, making sure that there are no peanut sandwiches in lunchboxes. All of that emotional and physical support of a family unit came with me still working full time. And I did more recently move to another position in a similar industry that allowed me the flexibility that I knew I needed as the primary caregiver to my children, which alleviated the guilt of being a working mom, because it's something that we all face at some point. And I picked up the majority of that parenting load.
And I think this is a very typical story of many mothers. We default into the position of caregiver, and we will make decisions and choices around our career and our earning potential in order to be able to carry the family load, as you spoke about. But what did that mean to you financially? Why are you sitting here today saying, I think I should have done things differently? What was the impact?
So you've talked about the default decisions that we make, and I made some practical default decisions to become the primary caregiver, and at the same time made some default decisions around our finances. We built a house, which my husband put in his name, and he took on a lot of the household expenses. And I took on, with the salary that I've been earning over the last couple of years, the full cost of raising our children. And when you actually sit down and calculate how much it costs to have and raise children in this day and age, it's a lot. I put a lot of my income and annual bonuses, when we were lucky enough to have those paid to us, into a school fee account, which we drew down on pretty much every single year to fund private school fees. It was a decision that we made as parents that we wanted our children to have that kind of an education. And where my spouse at the time was contributing towards a large asset in the form of a house, and we all know, unless you're going through times of rising interest rates like we are now, bond payments go down over time.
Well, as you be static, yeah.
Yes, as you pay off a large portion of the capital of that. Whereas I found myself contributing towards an increasing expense and a 15 to 17 year liability in effect, which is educating your children and providing them with that foundational education that they're going to need as adults. I did also over the last 20 years contribute towards a pension and provident fund, and whatever I was able to invest in a managed fund, I did so. But the priority for me has always and will always remain my children and ensuring that I'm able to provide them with that education that they're going to need. The relevance of these financial decisions really only became apparent to me now when I separated from my spouse. And as much as I have maintained a career, I've got a qualification in the form of a university degree, what that means for me is that there's no form of restitutive maintenance due to me. And it's going to be near impossible for me to ever quantify the potential lost opportunity that I made in terms of different career decisions in order to remain close to the kids, have that flexibility that I needed. And this is just one of those calculations that you can never really do and prepare for going forward.
So if you now knew what you know now, what would you have done differently going back to the beginning of your marriage or when you had children? What do you think you could have done differently that you wouldn't be sitting here today with these concerns?
We call this a conversation. And this conversation and the ones that we're going to have going forward all stem from the fact that I probably didn't talk enough about this over my marriage. I didn't talk about this enough with my spouse. We didn't have those discussions around the best thing for the family unit as well as the best thing for us individually. You don't enter into a marriage with the view that it's going to end, because that's not why we're getting married. But if I'd put more time up front into questioning some of the decisions that we'd made, understanding, for example, the implications of entry values into our marriage contract and how those would be impacted over time, there were just so many conversations I never had, and I made decisions without really questioning or debating them. And I fell into what seemed to be a natural position from a financial perspective. And having children and being a working mom, you just really, life is just about keeping your head above water more often than not. And if I could ever have redone any of this, I would certainly sit down and spend more time having discussions about the future and understanding future longer-term implications of the short-term decisions that we make in the immediate point of time.
You know, Andrew, I just want to say thank you. Thank you for sharing that with our listeners. That was, it's not easy, and it was very, very brave.
It feels brave. And I really just want to make sure that women hear the story and we start having more conversations about these kinds of things.
And that's exactly why we have our first guest in these conversations. So welcome, Beverly Clark, who is a leading attorney and a specialist in family law. Bev, you've been listening in. You've heard Andrea's story. You see a lot. Does this resonate with you? Is this common? Is this what happens in many marriages?
It's so common, Maya. And as you and I have discussed, it's a story that I hear so often in many different forms. And I think that the single most important thing for us to get across to people who might be watching or listening is normalize the conversation. It is it's a critically important conversation to have. And I think that lawyers have to take responsibility for the fact that in South Africa, antenuptial contracts are considered some sort of a tick box exercise. People try to get the cheapest one that they can get, rather than understanding and sitting down with two separate attorneys and understanding exactly what they're going to do in this contract that might be the most important contract they ever sign. And people are willing to pay, as we know, often hundreds of thousands of rand for their wedding, but they don't want to pay 5,000 rand for an antenuptial contract and for the legal process. And so I think that the for me, it's about normalizing the conversation.
You know, Andrew, when Andrew was telling me her story, I was thinking, but this ANC with a cruel, talking about the tick box, right? I know, you know, married in community of property, we know is a dangerous marriage contract because you inherit your spouse's debt. There's a shared property, but the debt is an issue and all these things. We've got a lot of, that's a default marriage in South Africa. So you just go and get an antenuptial contract with a cruel. That's fair. But then you hear Andrew's story, you realize this isn't the end of it. So maybe it help us understand the marriage contract environment in South Africa and how we can improve it.
So I think I should start from scratch and say that in South Africa, you can be married either in community of property or out of community of property. As you say, if you don't have an antenuptial contract, the default position is that you married in community of property. That will, in future, I think, change. And I think that the Law Reform Commission will eventually get their way and that will change. And the default position will be an accrual system where you share what you make during the marriage, because marriage is fundamentally a partnership. On the other hand, you can get married without out of community of property. And then you have two choices, to marry with the accrual or to marry without the accrual. The accrual, and I will tell you, I had a client who said he's married with the cruelty. And means, as I say, that you share what in some countries they call the marital acquiesce, what we've acquired through our blood, sweat and tears, not through inheritances and donations, but what we've acquired together during the marriage. And, you know, you say, actually, I'm now seeing the accrual system's not so fair either. In an ideal world, the accrual system is fair, but I'll tell you how people abuse it. The other option is marrying without accrual. Now, that means that you are saying what's yours is yours and what's mine is mine. And neither of us will ever have any claims against the other, except to the extent that we have written them into this contract, or to the extent that during the marriage, we choose to register assets in our joint names. Okay, so that requires, ideally, a lot of openness during the marriage. And, you know, as you say, we'll talk about these things. Should we actually put the house in one party's name? Should we put it in both our names? Should we both be paying the school fee so that one of us is not paying for all the consumables and the other one is just is building wealth? The reason that the accrual system sometimes fails us is because of, number one, high commencement values, which are then automatically increased by the CPI.
So commencement values is how the assets you entered the marriage.
What I'm worth at the time of the marriage, it's what my assets are worth at the time of the marriage. In addition to, or instead of, stating a commencement value, you can exclude specific assets. So for instance, you could say, I'm excluding from the operation of the accrual, my investment was 91. Certain people who are not marrying in good faith, perhaps, and I can tell you that I've seen a lot of them over the years, they will just put all their wealth into that investment and they excluded it at the time of the marriage. And then during the marriage, whatever they make, they shove into that investment. At the end of the marriage, they say, yeah, you know, I might have 50 million there, but it doesn't form part of it's an excluded asset. That is so, so common. The other thing that people do is that they plant a seed, well, even there, I suppose, but they plant a seed. So they say, I'm excluding my business. Very common. And what happens if you exclude an asset is that any asset you later acquire by virtue of your current possession of that asset is also excluded. So you can have a teeny weeny corner shop when you get married, and one day you own a string of Pick and Pays or whatever, so that the seed can turn into a forest, and then you say the entire forest is excluded. That is also a common scenario. And those, for me, are abuses of the accrual system. And again, I think that eventually the Law Reform Commission will change these things, but the way for it to change is that our courts have to have discretion to look back over the marriage at the time of divorce and to say, does this antenuptial contract, if I enforce it strictly, does it give rise to manifest unfairness or gross injustice? The court must be able to interfere in the interests of justice in certain circumstances. It doesn't mean that your ANC means nothing, not at all. But I think that a court has to be able to look ex post facto, look back over the marriage and decide whether it is grossly unfair. Not whether it is absolutely fair, but whether it is grossly unfair. Should they be able to redistribute assets in a slightly different way?
And I know, Bev, you're very involved in this and you've been making presentations to the Constitutional Court around this, and especially in circumstances where someone has stayed at home and raised the children and the ANC has been basically unfair. It's leaving them sort of high and dry. But how you spoke about sitting down and spending the money to have a proper marriage contract put in place, but how do you... It's an evolving thing. You don't know when you're 25 and getting married what your choices are going to be going forward. Is there a way to allow your contract to morph, be fair? I don't know. How do you do this?
It's never going to be totally flexible, Maya, because the fact is you're putting a contract in place. You know, a contract has certain provisions. But an intimate contract is different. You can never fully know what the future facts and circumstances are going to be. And a marriage contract is only enforced at the end of the marriage. And how do you know at the beginning of the marriage exactly what is going to have happened over the course of the marriage? So as you say, for instance, we're in the Constitutional Court waiting for judgment, actually, in a matter in which a very courageous woman who had been married for 30 years, had raised 3 children, was married when she was 22, her prospective father-in-law said to her, you either marry the day before the wedding, you either sign this contract or you're not getting married. That is very, very common. And so what did she do? I mean, there were all these people coming to the wedding and she had a beautiful dress and they had caterers and whatever else. Of course, she signed the contract. ANC without accrual. Okay, what's yours is yours and what's mine is mine. Her husband went on to make hundreds of millions. And 30 years later, and she worked alongside him. They were a farming family and he became a very high-tech farming industry. But as you will know, farmers' wives work, you know, 24/7 really alongside their husbands and raising the children and taking the children a long way in and out of town to and working with the community, all those things. And at the end of the marriage, he said, sorry for you. You get nothing because of our prenup. And it was and I've seen that happen so many times in my 30 years doing this. And we finally found a client who was brave enough to say, no, I want to take this on. It's just not fair. And she has done that, Mrs. Kraling. She's very brave. And we're going to, I think that the argument went extremely well. And I'm cautiously optimistic that the Constitutional Court is going to come out in her favor. And that will make a difference to thousands and thousands of women, where all we've asked is that the court must be able to have a discretion at the end of the marriage.
It's an interesting point you raise there, and something I see a lot in my social circle are stay-at-home moms who take on a lot of parenting, and because the theme of this is going to be conversational, don't have those conversations with their spouse at the time when the marriage is going well around protecting themselves and ensuring that they're not financially vulnerable and to give themselves financial independence. I know we're not having enough of these conversations. What advice have you got for women who need to now start preparing for the worst while not offending their spouse in order to initiate these kinds of conversations?
You might have to ask the relationship expert. But I think that the starting point is to really encourage young people and certainly to educate attorneys to say people should have independent legal advice before they get married. What people do, honestly, still 95-98% of people in South Africa who want antenuptial contracts, they both go and see the same attorney. And in England and Wales, for instance, an antenuptial, what they call a prenup, in which you have not had independent legal advice, is just not enforceable. And so I insist, actually I have for many years, because how many South Africans move overseas all the time? I insist that people have independent legal advice. Those two attorneys are not going to be at each other's throats at all. They're going to collaborate, and they know that you want to be married and you want to be happily married, but they are really going to help you to ask questions that you might otherwise feel uncomfortable about asking. Because as you say, it's very difficult to sit there when you're in the bloom of love and pre-marriage. It's very difficult. Some people are very uncomfortable about having those conversations. And I see those dynamics, the relationship dynamic, even when people come, if people do want to come together. And as I say, I then still insist one goes to see somebody else. But you can see the dynamic if there is a power imbalance or if one of them is going into the ANC in bad faith. And you can only hope that as an attorney, sometimes you can, I have on occasion gently given advice that perhaps you really must rethink this marriage because this is what a disaster it's going to be for you financially.
That's so interesting. If you could, I mean, because I suppose if you can't, if you're really acting in bad faith, you're not married yet. I mean, you know, the first marital fight, you know, where is that going to go? I mean, I think that is so such a powerful thought. And I also find, Bev, you know, when you've got that third party, that other person, and you can almost blame them for bringing it up.
No, so they told me to ask.
They told me to ask. And I think, you know, when you have a financial planner, often they can also start asking questions that perhaps you're scared to raise. I think you almost have a little bit of a champion in your corner. But I also wanted to ask you, Bev, you and I, we were chatting a little bit before this recording, and you were saying that what's interesting is that you know, people always want to make sure they get their fair share out of a divorce. And I said to you, well, but don't you find that sometimes women are prepared to walk away from things because they don't want conflict? So maybe that's less of an issue. But then you were also saying that women, if the woman is the breadwinner, so we've been talking here about Andrea's case where she was not the main breadwinner. There are women who have very successful businesses. They are powerful women, and their husband may be the one who stayed at home or has taken the second, you know, the lower income work in order to be there for the children. And you were saying that she often finds it very difficult to share more than a man does.
Mm. I think that's correct, but perhaps the scenario in which that is most common is not the one where the husband or the other spouse has taken the primary role with the children. It is the one in which the woman has done everything. So she has still been the primary caregiver of the children and the homemaker and the home manager and the staff manager, etc. And she has made more money than her spouse. In those situations in particular, women are very, very resentful about then having to enforce their antenuptial contracts when it means they have to give up half their wealth. But I will frankly tell you that even when that hasn't been the situation, sometimes feminism is hard for us. And even though I think for generations men have taken it for granted that at the end of a marriage they're going to have to share, they might not have loved it, but they knew that it would have to happen. Sometimes it's been hard for women to swallow that, in truth.
My own dad gave me advice 25 years ago. The first advice he gave me was, don't go into HR. I don't think you have the personality for this. And that was very smart of him. And the follow-up advice was that he didn't envy the decision I was going to need to make at some point in the future as to how I was going to manage motherhood and a full-time working career if that's what I wanted. And I look back now, 20 years later, and I think, gosh, Dad, I don't know if you knew quite how hard it was going to be. And that's why I think so many of us just fall into the default roles that we do and take on too much of everything. And I don't regret being a full-time working person. I don't regret being more flexible in my career to look after my children. They are the best gifts I'll ever give myself. But I now face a situation midway through my career and midway through my earning potential where I need to do things differently. And if I had the ability to go back, I would certainly make some different decisions. There are some great ones that I made. There were some unwise ones that I made. But I know now, looking back, I would certainly sit down and debate more around, for example, commencement values. I don't think I ever really understood what those meant at the time and the impact of those 15 years later with annual CPI inflation increases and how that was going to impact me financially now at this age. And those are the questions that we don't ask. Those are the debates we don't have. And those are the kind of conversations that I need more women to be having at the point at which they are getting caught up in wedding shoes and honeymoon destinations. Stop and think about where you might be. You're never going to get it right. You'll never guess with 100% certainty where you're going to be 20, 30 years down the line. But at least asking those questions better prepares you for wherever you might end up.
And I want to swing back on that. You know, if you have been perhaps a full stay-at-home mom, or you have made choices to take a different career path in order to look after the children, what would you call rehabilitation or maintenance can you actually claim for in divorce? Or is that all governed by the divorce contract and the marriage contract?
No. Rehabilitative maintenance is not in any way governed by the marriage contract. Andrea is in a particularly difficult situation, as are many, many women. Rehabilitative maintenance is determined on the basis of a number of factors. One of them, and perhaps the primary one, is your income earning capacity. So if you have an income earning ability, which clearly Andrea does, she's highly educated, she's experienced, she has, in anyone's terms, a good career. But what she's saying is it's not quite as good as it could have been had I not taken that time. So if you are in a situation where one spouse has taken time off completely, and when they get divorced, that person literally has to go and re-enter the job market, that's the kind of person who will get rehabilitative maintenance. Or if you are of an age where you're unlikely to be able to work anymore, maybe you're getting divorced when you're 60 plus, or you have other conditions, which mean you don't have an income earning ability, or you don't have capital. If you have capital to support yourself, you're also not going to get, or if you're getting capital in the divorce, sufficient capital, you're also not going to get rehabilitative maintenance. And certainly there's a tendency worldwide to move away from permanent post-divorce spousal maintenance. Rehabilitative maintenance is only enough to get you back on your feet, but it's a sort of a common sense thing. It's like, if I need it, you know, will I get it? And then yes, usually for a short period, 1 to 5 years, you will get it, but not when you're already earning a high income. I think what Andrea is talking about is her loss of career potential, what's sometimes called a career asset. And it's those, that earning capacity, that her earning capacity is not where it would have been. And it's her loss of that career asset that she's asking, can I be compensated for that? And at present, in our law, and as I've been looking at this week in most jurisdictions around the world, you can't be compensated for that. Its career assets have specifically been determined not to be an asset. New York is one exception. They do to some extent recognize them, and the Law Reform Commission is proposing that in South Africa that be taken into account in the future. But I think that we are several years off those changes to our Matrimonial Property Act coming into effect.
And if those changes come into effect, would they be retrospective? So anyone getting divorced from that date? Or?
It's a big question mark at the beginning of the discussion paper that's recently been published by the Law Reform Commission. Is, you know, one of the biggest questions that the legislature is going to have to battle with is, should these changes be retrospective or not? Usually laws are not changed retrospectively.
Well, I think really in a nutshell, it is, you know, a lot of this does come up about the fact that we default into these roles and we don't think and don't have the conversations about what that will mean. No, nobody sits there and says, okay, I'll be the primary caregiver. I'm going to lose maybe 30, 40% of my career potential. How are we going to balance that out? That conversation, I assure you, doesn't happen in any marriage. And that is what these conversations are about, because I think these are the conversations we need to start having. So I really want to thank you, Bev, for your insights on that.
I think if there are women out there, and I've got a lot of them in my social circle that did elect to stop working for a period of time, not to assume the worst, but to prepare for the worst. And it is a difficult thing to suggest because of the connotations that come with that. But I think there are so many women out there that may have taken themselves out of the job market and need to start, coming back to the theme, having conversations around what they could do to get themselves back into possibly a different career, but back into the employment sector, and prepare themselves for either that and conversely at the same time, if it is important to them, to make sure that they've got assets in their own name and how those are contributed towards as a part of the family expenses.
100%. And that if there's one thing that I could tell young women, and in fact young people, you know, who might get married, and I'm talking of any gender or sexuality, just try not to become financially dependent on your spouse.
I was actually going to ask you, Bev, what would you tell your children getting married? Would that be it?
Yeah, it would be the independent legal advice, have the conversation, and don't ever become financially dependent.
And it is such a perfect note to end on, because in our next conversation, we're going to be chatting to Sunil Feltman, who's a financial planner, about creating that financial independence in a relationship. So thank you very much, Bev and Andrea. And please, to our listeners, remember to send us your feedback and the topics that you want us to be talking about, because we want to be here to help you have those conversations that often for us feel like taboos, things we can't have. And hopefully these conversations you can share with your family, your friends, your perhaps spouses, your to-be spouses, and start having the conversation.